Venenos tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros. No ves que no estamos solos, millones de polo a polo. Al son de un solo coro marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción que basta de robo. Tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro, tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro. No, la hora sonó, la hora sonó. No permitiremos más, más tu doctrina del shock. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. This week we're speaking with Dawn Paley, author of the upcoming book from AK Press, Drug War Capitalism, about the mass disappearances of 43 teaching students in the city of Iguala in the southern states of Guerrero in southern Mexico, and the discovery of multiple mass graves around the city. The mass kidnapping has led to transparency of the ties between narcos, paramilitaries, and the PRD-led government in that state, and public reaction, including the burning of the government buildings in the state, and solidarity across Mexico in the form of resistance. First, here's Sean Swain talking about his gubernatorial bid.
A la calle, mapuches, estudiantes y docentes reclamando al gobierno una mejor educación.
Golpe a golpe, verso a verso, con las ganas y el aliento, con cenizas, con el fuego.
What you say, what you say, what you say, what? We're calling like a war!
I've gotten mail recently asking how my campaign for governor is going. In case you didn't know, I'm running for Ohio governor, and the election is November 3rd. Hope I can count on your support. My platform is pretty simple, and can be summed up with a catchphrase that's as inspiring as it is grammatically incorrect. I make total destroy. Ohio calls itself the heart of it all. That's what you see on the signs alongside the highway when you have the misfortune of coming here anyway. So it's my goal, as governor of Ohio, to drive a wooden stake right through the heart of it all. Here's my 90-day plan. First, by executive order, I would decommission the Ohio National Guard and give their heavy weaponry to the Native American tribes who were here first. They could use that to take back what they want. Second, I'll empty all the prisons. 50,000 prisoners liberated, not one fence to remain standing. So think about that. No military, no prisons, no way to control the population. Goodbye, civilization. The emerging Ohio Autonomous Zone would be free of banksters, profiteers, and bosses. The state of Ohio would cease to exist. So would the system of international capital, at least within our territorial borders. We're talking a state-sized occupy encampment, defended with Apache attack helicopters. Sounds like a party, huh? And just to assure you I won't go power mad and remain in charge, I've already signed a sworn statement that if I'm still in office past 90 days from the date I'm sworn in, it's legal to shoot me. That's right. I'm the first political candidate who has ever legalized his own assassination if he reneges on his promises. Abolish the state of Ohio. Vote for me. My hope, of course, is that the collapse of Ohio will have a domino effect, turning Indiana and Pennsylvania, Kentucky and Michigan into failed states. Well, Michigan already is, I guess. And before you know it, total liberation from the hierarch delusion, from the pathology of state worship. We'll all be living in yurts, foraging for food, like the good old days before Europeans screwed everything up. That was the plan. I even have posters at SeanSwain.org. My personal favorite features a weasel wearing a tie and sporting an oversized erect penis and large scrotum. Sure hope I can say erect penis and enlarged scrotum on the radio. Supporters can plaster these posters everywhere or staple them together for a children's coloring book. Kids love weasels, you know. Unfortunately, Ohioans have little imagination to envision a stateless world. So, I attempted to lure people from out of state to hijack the election. I only needed 1 million people. By my campaign's best calculations, we got 7. And that's when Governor Jaywell's evil minions put me on black site status 8 weeks. What happened was, I sent Governor Jaywell an anatomically correct prototype of my action figure. And since it's anatomically correct, you know he looked. You know he did. Sources close to Jaywell tell me that he ordered me placed on black site status when he saw the size of the action figure's junk. Governor Jaywell was convinced I was false advertising and insisted on seeing my penis for comparison. While I was on black site status, Jaywell even had the black choppers that harassed Ross Perot circling outside my cell window, trying to snap photos of me when I urinated. That's right, Governor Jaywell was obsessed with my penis. And though I was let off black site status after 8 weeks, my campaign could never catch up with the corporate party, the state worshippers. And sales of my anatomically correct action figure just never took off as well as you might have expected. So, my campaign has a new plan. Rubber mallet. We need my supporters to show up early to vote on November 3rd. All of Ohio's voting machines are electronic, and they're sometimes glitchy. So show up early and bring a rubber mallet. After voting for me on the touchscreen, make sure the vote is processed by touching the screen just a little more assertively with the rubber mallet. We want your vote to register, just in case the voting machines across the state mysteriously break down. No idea how that might happen, and advocating the destruction of voting machines is probably illegal, but if the few voters who got their votes in voted for me, it's a brave new world, sports fans. I recommend rubber mallets if the voting centers might have metal detectors. You should try to avoid having to explain why you're carrying around a metal claw hammer. Delusional hierarchs can be so dense. I don't want to be Ohio's next governor. I want to be Ohio's last governor. Abolish the state of Ohio. Abolish civilization. Vote for me on November 3rd. For Esan, this is anarchist prisoner Sean Flynn from Ohio Supermax facility, running for Ohio governor on November 3rd. And I approve this message.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. I'm pleased to welcome the author and journalist Dawn Paley back onto The Final Straw. Y'all may remember Dawn from our conversation last year on drug war capitalism. Dawn is also the author of a new title from AK Press by that same name, Drug War Capitalism. Thanks for coming back on, Dawn.
It's a pleasure.
Can you lay out what happened on September 26th, 2014 in Iguala in the Mexican state of Guerrero?
Sure. As folks have likely heard by now, that was the day that Mexican police murdered six people and kidnapped 57 people. Most of the people, among the people who were murdered, there were students and civilian victims who were killed by gunshot wounds when police opened fire on various buses. And their justification for it was that they got confused and they thought there were drug cartels among the victims or drug cartel members. And then later in the evening that same day, 57 students were kidnapped by the police. Well, they were actually detained by the police. A couple days later, some of them were released, 14 of them were released, and 43 of the students are still disappeared. What was happening that day on the 26th of September was that students were demonstrating. They were carrying out a protest at an event that the wife of the mayor of Iguala was holding, and they were also collecting money in order to travel to Mexico City for the commemoration of October 2nd, which is a commemoration of October 2nd, 1968, when Mexico remembers the many dozens of people who were murdered by Mexican paramilitary forces. They were a paramilitary police forces on October 2nd, 1968, 10 days before the 1968 Olympics. So you had a demo, you had students going around collecting money, but they were wearing school uniforms. These are students at a teacher's college in Ayotzinapa, just outside of Iguala. And the police response to the student protests and to the arrival of the students was, first of all, bloodshed, and second of all, this ongoing situation where we have now 43 students between the ages of 18 and 23 who have been disappeared since September 26.
How many was that?
Well, there was 57 kidnapped initially, and 14 of them were later released. When I say kidnapped, I mean they were detained by police, but it turns out to have been a kidnapping. So there was 57 who were originally detained, 14 of them were released, and 43 of the students remained disappeared.
Can you talk about the teachers' college that the students come from and why its students might be a strategic target for the police? And also, do you know the specifics of what that protest was around for the wife of the mayor's event?
They're basically protesting against the municipal government, and she became a legitimate target, you know, for protests. And the school is a normal school. It's a teachers' training college, and it has a long history of activism, and, you know, the slogan for the school is Cradle of Social Justice. Students there are, you know, often from the majority of them are from poor families and from marginalized communities. And it's a school that just has this long tradition of leftist organizing by the students, of teaching communism, you know, of teaching different values from capitalist values, and of resistance as well to programs of austerity. And, you know, a couple of guerrilla leaders, historic guerrilla leaders, have gone through that school, as have social people who later have gone on to become social actors throughout the country. So there's been a long history of repression against students from not just the normal school in Ayotzinapa, but also these normal schools or teacher training colleges throughout the country.
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating for me to like look through. I think it was the Vice article on the subject, and it was listing out some of the guerrillas who had been members of or who had attended the college. And I recognized a couple of the names, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's like quite a history to this one establishment. It's pretty amazing that the institution still exists. You know,
absolutely, and they've had to fight to continue to exist. I mean, there's been numerous attempts over the years, and, you know, especially recently, to shut down the schools, or the now jailed head of the teachers' union in Mexico, Elba Esther Gordillo, had proposed a couple years ago that the normal schools should be like turned into schools where they train students in like tourism and management and marketing. So basically completely change the nature of these schools. But they have resisted and they have fought to continue, you know, to be trained as teachers, to be able to work in the public system, and to continue with the, you know, their ongoing, you know, activism and important mobilizations throughout Mexico.
How did the word of what transpired on the 26th get out, and how did the Guerrero and federal Mexican governments respond?
Well, first we heard that there had been shootouts, and of course the media presented them as having initially been between police and sicarios, or hitmen, basically, with organized crime. That story is being, you know, has been recanted as the survivors, you know, talk about how police opened fire on school buses full of students wearing like jackets from the school. Do you know what I mean? Like and they were being shot at, and they were being told, if you don't shut up, we're going to kill you, by police. So the, you know, initial version was quickly demystified by survivors a couple days later. With regards to the disappearance, first it was that 57 students had been arrested. And then later, I think on the next day, which would have been Saturday the 27th, there was a question of, like, where are they? Like, they're not in police custody. They're not at the Ministerio Público. They haven't been brought by police for interrogation, or, you know, where are they? 14 of the students were released, and then after that, we don't know anything about where the other 43 students are. The official line that's being used by the government of Mexico, the federal government, is that the police officers are corrupt police officers who are working with an organized crime group called Guerreros Unidos, and that the police handed the students off to this group of organized crime, and then for reasons that they can't really articulate very well, because I don't think they're true, they claim that these organized criminals, this group of organized crime, may have either, you know, killed the students, but has certainly disappeared them. I mean, they may be alive, they may be dead, we don't know. I prefer to think of this as a state crime, myself and many others. It's very clearly a state crime. And I don't, you know, think that the whole discourse about there being some kind of narco-trafficking involved in this is true at all. I think that, you know, the police it appears that they turned the students over to certainly what we could call a paramilitary group, or a group that works very closely with police and state security forces. And after that, we don't know anything. I mean, these students so far have literally vanished. Like, we don't know where they are. Then what happened a couple weeks after, which I think was 2 weekends ago, is that Mexican authorities announced that they'd found mass graves outside of the city of Iguala. I believe the count for the amount of mass graves they've found is now up to 27, but they've only confirmed that they've found 28 bodies. We know there's definitely more bodies, but we don't know how many because the Mexican government simply is not providing the information. Some of the graves have been found by community police, and some of them have been found by state forces. Initially, the state had, basically said these bodies might belong to the students. The bodies were cut into pieces. They were burned. There was signs of torture. And so the identification process, which was also blocked, which was also interfered with by the Mexican government, took a couple of weeks. And so far now, what we know a couple of days ago, the Mexican government said, well, actually, none of the bodies are the students' bodies. So we're talking about another series of massacres in Iguala, another series of bodies, a number of bodies, we don't know how many. And again, the students, 43 students, still disappeared.
How many bodies does it take to be define something as a mass grave?
Well, usually two or three. I mean, but they talk about clandestine graves in Mexico that can include one body, but I mean, a massacre is defined as three or more people. So a mass grave would be, I guess, two or more bodies.
Like, upon the news getting out of the missing students and about the lies that were coming out about the activities of the local government and police, how did officials in Iguala?
So the mayor of Iguala and his wife, who was being protested that day, they fled. They're currently fugitives of justice. The governor of Guerrero is, people are demanding that he resign from his position, which he so far refused to do. He is a member of the PRD party, which used to be the party of Manuel López Obrador, which is, somewhat of a leftist party, or has been identified as a leftist party in Mexico. So the governor is refusing to resign. The mayor is on the run. The mayor is also from the PRD party, the mayor of Iguala and his partner. And then initially, basically what the federal government said, Enrique Peña Nieto, what he said like the first weekend after the students were detained, was that this is a state issue. This is an issue for Guerrero State to deal with, and the federal government has no jurisdiction, basically. We have no responsibility to investigate these crimes. Once the graves were found, Enrique Peña Nieto had to change his tone almost completely and admit, he had to say, okay, actually the federal government is needing to get involved here. And since then has, spoken out many times about how much he's hurting and how sad he is and how hard the federal police and the army are looking for these bodies and so on. But, what we're actually seeing is empty discourse and also the militarization of places, of different areas and villages and cities throughout Guerrero State. So instead of sending, army and police to actually go look for these young men who are disappeared, army and police are being sent in en masse and to occupy towns and cities in Guerrero. So the whole thing is actually being used as a pretext to continue to militarize Guerrero State and sow more fear and terror among the population.
Leftist and liberal media in the U.S. has at times presented the PRD as like a challenger with an alternative to the entrenched and corrupt PRI, which ran the country federally from the revolution till 2000. What differences lie between the Democratic Revolutionary Party and the Institutional Revolutionary Party? And what was the PRD's role in this massacre?
Well, in name, there is a difference. Supposedly, like, the PRD is a leftist party. But okay, the PRI is back in power now in Mexico, right? And this is crucial to keep in mind. So since December 1st, 2012, Enrique Peña Nieto from the PRI is the president of the country, and we're back in a PRI-ruled country here. Shortly after the PRI came back into power in late December, they started something called Pacto por México, or Pact for Mexico, and that was a pact between the PRI, the PRD, and the PAN party, P-A-N party. So essentially right off, the PRD pacted with the PRI at the very beginning of this administration and followed to accept the pushing through of a series of reforms and austerity measures over the next year. The Pact for Mexico has since come apart, but I mean, I think the fact that the PRD pacted with the PRI for over a year is extremely significant. I mean, it tells us how much of an actual left we're talking about here, right? And in terms of the PRD's role in the massacre, I mean, you have the governor of Guerrero State who is being directly fingered as responsible by people in Guerrero, as well as the mayor of Iguala, who is also being directly fingered as responsible and as both colluding with these paramilitary groups or organized crime groups. And so they're both part of the PRD. I mean, there was a protest on October 8th. Well, there was a series of protests throughout Mexico, and one of the sort of people who's considered a moral leader of the PRD, his name is Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, he went to the demo as if people were going to accept him and as if people were going to be okay with seeing, you know, the leader of a political party that's deeply entrenched in and responsible for these disappearances. And people, you know, they roughed him up a little bit and threw some pylons and garbage at him that day. And that, you know, is just one sort of evidence, I guess, of people's real discontent with all of the political parties in this country.
It's crazy to think that the National Action Party was also one of the pacted parties, because that's all three of the parties, or not PRD, but PAN, unseated, PRI from the presidency. And so that's the three largest parties, as far as I'm aware, in Mexico, like all joining into, I guess, a unity government of some sort. But
exactly.
That's bizarre.
That's exactly what it is. So, I mean, Manuel Andrés López Obrador, he left the PRD party and formed another, what was originally called a citizens movement, but it's actually now a political party as well. It's called Morena. But they have like a few congresspeople. But he separated from the PRD and brought some people with him, some of the congresspeople with him, as the PRD pacted Pacto por México, but also other deals, which is making a lot of deals with PRI in other states of Mexico. So there is an offshoot. It's supposedly more leftist. But basically, yeah, I mean, political politics in this country is one of the most uninspiring places you can look in terms of change, you know, possible. Like anyone that's, you know, doing meaningful organizing in this country is doing so outside of party structures.
I guess to return back to the forensics and to the grave site, you've written that an Argentine forensic team was brought in and had difficulties actually carrying out the studies of the mass graves. What did they face and what did they find?
Well, they basically were delayed from beginning work until five of the original graves had already been emptied out completely. That was, you know, done by the local justice department, basically, in Guerrero, who refused to give them the permits that they needed in order to start the dig until 2 days had gone by after their arrival. And what that means is that key pieces of evidence are destroyed, right? So the Mexican government teams that are digging these bodies are just pulling them out of the ground. Then we have no idea what's happening to them or where they're, you know, being identified or how the identification is taking place. So what, you know, the Argentine forensics team, which is working closely with the families as well of the young men, you know, Brent comes with a lot of experience and is able to work a lot more carefully and is also obviously not self-interested in destroying evidence or absconding evidence the way the Mexican state is. So, you know, that was basically... And it's a typical thing. It happens all the time here when there's mass graves discovered, like that the forensic work or forensic experts are denied access to the sites until the evidence is basically destroyed by the state.
Are there any ideas about who actually lies in the graves if it's not the students? And how old are the graves from what you've heard?
We don't know. We don't know how old the graves are, but the assumption is that they're fairly new because when journalists were on the site the day after they were discovered, they talked about smelling the odor of burnt flesh because the bodies had been burned before they were put into the graves. So, you know, we don't know how long they were there exactly, but certainly if you could still smell that smell, it indicates that they had been recently buried. What was the second part of the question?
Who they might have been.
Oh, we don't know. I mean, there has been hundreds of mass graves dug in Mexico that have been discovered since 2006, and only 11% of the bodies in all of the mass graves in the country, or all of the clandestine mass graves in the country, only 11% have ever been identified. So just like all of these other graves in Mexico, like, we don't know who the victims are. We can assume that the Mexican government has said that they don't match the identities of the students, but they have not said who they are. And that is basically par for the course in this country.
What has public response been like in Mexico?
Well, you know, it was a little bit slow to get going. Even on the day of October 2nd, when people across the country protest in memory of 1968, the call for the students to be returned alive was not sort of the main focus of this, the memorial demo remembering the student massacre in 1968. So really it was October 8th that the first national demonstrations took place in Mexico, and that's almost 2 weeks after the students were disappeared. But since then, it's been amazing in the sense that there's been demonstrations all over the country on a regular basis. UNAM and multiple other major public universities went on strike for 2 days last week, and they're going to strike again this week, as are universities throughout the country. There's been caravans going. There's been caravans bringing aid as well to the families who are continuing the search. There's been a huge amount of media coverage. So, you know, it was definitely slow to get going. But since then, like, every day, I live in Puebla outside of Mexico City, and like every day there's something. Like yesterday, the normal school students from Puebla did another demonstration, and then we met some of them in a park where they were doing fundraising. There's all kinds of events happening all the time, and there's also a lot of assemblies, and, like, you know, graphic arts collectives are working on graphic arts, and everybody is trying to communicate. And basically, you know, the main message that people are trying to get out is, you know, that we want these students back alive. We want all 43 of them to be returned healthy. And, you know, after that, there's a lot of other demands, but that's sort of like the primary piece for mobilization. Also in Guerrero State, they announced an action plan on Thursday. So for organizations and students in Guerrero, they today, for example, are doing highway blockades, and they're refusing to let transnational corporations people pass. They're not letting any trucks or any, like, of the, you know, Coca-Cola or any of those vehicles pass through. They have taken over 82 municipalities in the state of Guerrero, and they plan to do so indefinitely. They are planning to take over radio stations tomorrow and Monday. And basically they say, like, if the students aren't returned, they're working to create the conditions for the dissolution of the Mexican government, of the government of Guerrero. They want no federal involvement. They want no police involvement in the search. And the search for these students, they don't want any militarization. They want the community police to be recognized as the only legitimate security group in the state of Guerrero. So basically, the people in Guerrero are highly mobilized right now, ongoing blockades throughout the state. Also, it's worth pointing out that the state Congress and the city hall of Chilpancingo, the capital of Guerrero, were both lit on fire on Tuesday last week. And since then, the state Congress has not been able to meet in Guerrero State because they basically burned the entire Congress down.
I read today in an article that there were 35 buses that were taken by students in Michoacán, filled with students, and then moved into, or 20 of them at least, moved into Guerrero in, like, an act of solidarity. And the authors were unsure about what the use of the buses would be because there were so many of them. Is there, like, a tradition of hijacking vehicles and offering solidarity in that way? And I guess, would the vehicles be used for transportation or for barricades? Or
Yeah, no, there is definitely tradition of that happening. And, you know, the normal, the members of the normal school in Ayotzinapa are known for using that tactic. And they don't hijack buses with weapons, but they basically take over buses and let them fill with students who then don't pay to get transport. And I mean, so they use them for transport. They don't use them for, you know, like blockades. I mean, they could, but historically that it's been something where they use for transport. Like you see interviews with the bus drivers and stuff, and they say, yeah, this has happened before. This is fairly normal here. And it's not even particularly scary for the drivers. The schools are totally underfunded. The students don't have enough money to transport, to move themselves. And so I think that what I've read is that they consider the use of private buses by students as just sort of a temporary recuperation of what is theirs, the right to move.
And that same article kind of pointed to the fact that in a lot of cases the drivers are compensated somewhat for the lost wages of the time when the vehicles were taken.
Yeah.
So you talked about like the delegitimization of governmental authorities throughout the state, and like making it unmanageable or ungovernable, like making the state of Guerrero ungovernable until at least the 43 students are brought back. Can you talk about like what other groups are attempting to like take space in this vacuum of power, with the police being delegitimized in this way and with the state and federal governments being delegitimized in terms of their relationship with narcos and their transparency? Can you talk a little bit about like the auto defenses, for instance, and what roles they're playing in the search for the normalistas?
Sure. I mean, there's multiple groups, the CRAC, PC, the main community policing group in Guerrero, the UPOEC, which is another community policing group, which is closer to the government. And then self-defense groups as well have joined the search. And in terms of people who are taking space, you've got students throughout the country, like in every state of Mexico, from Tijuana to Cancun, taking over university campuses, taking over streets, taking over toll booths, blocking roads, taking over public space, and demanding the immediate return of the 43 students. So you've got, you know, there is no, this... This, the Mexican state is really not wanted or welcome by you know, all of us who are here, like, for example, students and people who are, you know, just, I mean, people are outraged about what happened on September 26th. I think the dominant sort of tone of the demonstrations that I've been to is total outrage. And, you know, there's always sort of a sense of impotence in a way, but at the same time, like, things are getting more and more active and people are continuing to organize. Like, so there's, you know, it's not like an impotence where you like go to a march and you go home and you're like, oh, too bad, I guess that's all there is. It's like, no, here there's assemblies like every single day here in Puebla. There's activities every single day. Like, people are really getting organized, you know, and I don't know how things are in Guerrero because I haven't been there, but it appears that there is like a very high level of coordination and organization to continue the search and to just to make sure that this continues to remain like the main issue in the country. We need to have those 43 students back alive.
We'll be back to our conversation with Dawn Paley after this musical break.
Protestas y bajo tu pecho todavía late un corazón. Protesta es la conciencia colectiva que despierta. Protesta es la marea humana que se manifiesta. Es tu derecho, pero más que eso es tu obligación. Protesta y bajo tu pecho todavía late un corazón. Protesta es la conciencia colectiva que despierta. Protesta es la marea humana que se manifiesta.
En este mundo de incierto caos, la gente se pregunta a dónde vamos. Si somos libres o somos esclavos, ya no existe diferencia en el agujero en el que estamos. Tenemos el poder de encontrar la salida, de
derecho a la expresión y al movimiento. Y difiero ante leyes verticales, reformas tripolares, violaciones, levantones y masacres. Por eso protesto contra el crimen más obsceno que se haya cometido y que se llama gobierno.
Aquí en mi tierra las cosas andan duras, lo mismo pasa en Salvador, Brasil, Honduras. Esto no va a parar hasta abolir la dictadura. Con disfraz de democracia, ser rebelde es mi cultura. Escucha el ruido de mi pueblo resurgiendo. Se rompe el hilo que nos está conteniendo y combatimos la mentira, el mal gobierno despierta. Juntos unimos la voz para decirte protesta.
Protesta más que un derecho, es una obligación. Cuando los medios mienten es porque te asiste la razón. Ni con bombas ni metrallas podrán callar la rabia acumulada que rodea la nación. Es por eso que voy a insistir, es por eso que voy a resistir. Porque todo lo que hoy hagamos o dejemos de hacer formará parte de la historia.
Llamando la atención para mi hermano el desconfiado. Él cayó, no procuró, se convirtió en el malvado. Yo no soy el creador para llamarte de nuevo a casa, pero seguro que en tu dolor reconocerás a tu propia raza. Por mi raza hablará el espíritu, ¿entiendes lo que digo? Lo habrás entendido cuando no discrimina a tus hijos. El mensaje clave, una proeza desde adelante. La protesta no es desmadre, despertarte de tu trance.
And now, back to our conversation with Don Paley, author of Drug War Capitalism, about the resistance to the Mexican government in light of the mass kidnapping of students in Guerrero, Mexico, and the discovery of collusion between the government and narcos and the finding of mass graves. I know it might include some speculation. Do you see, like, with such history of impunity and strange overlaps between narcos and federales and local polices and the parties being totally corrupt and interchanging power structures between them, not actually being competitive towards each other as you would expect in a quote-unquote like healthy democracy. Do you see the possibility of this expansion of resistance by students into something larger, like something that would actually create a counterforce of some sort to the Mexican state?
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, it's speculation, which I kind of want to avoid, but the level of mobilization, like I've been saying, is high, and it continues to grow. Unless they can return the 43 students alive, the Mexican state I think that, you know, there is a Mexico before Ayotzinapa. There is a Mexico before the state kidnapping and disappearance of 43 students, and there is a Mexico after. And they're two different countries in the sense that, you know, like stuff that's been going on around the country, especially since December 2006, when Felipe Calderón started the war on drug cartels, has finally become a national issue that has touched like millions of people across the country. So like I said, there's mass graves all over the country. There's been previous massacres in Mexico that have been blamed on the drug trade in ways where it's very difficult to prove and where the victims in their majority are students or poor folks, working folks, migrants, etc. But this is like, this is a different moment. This event, this mass kidnapping of these 43 young men, has changed the country, I think, forever.
Do you have ideas about how folks abroad might show solidarity with a community struggling against the collusion between Mexican officials and narcos?
Yeah, I mean, just first of all, talk to your friends and neighbors, try to share newspaper articles that are critical. I mean, for example, like, I've been putting out these pieces on the Media Co-op, just like short sort of updates about what's been going on. And one of the things people are writing me from Canada and stuff is like, well, all we hear in Canada is that these students were like really annoying, basically. Like these students were always protesting and they were always in the way. And then, you know, they got kidnapped and somehow there was confusion and now they're with the drug cartel. So I think what's really crucial here is that we talk to our friends, we talk to our neighbors. There's been mobilizations in the U.S. I think that's super useful, and I hope that those mobilizations continue. But it's crucial. I mean, it's crucial for people to know and to talk with each other and to let people around them know that this is a state crime. Okay, this is not a drug cartel thing. This is a state crime carried out with the participation of paramilitary groups directly targeting students in Mexico, and you know, the Mexican government would like things to go on as normal, but that's not going to happen. I'm working with some folks right now and trying to set up a system for people to give money and give donations to support the families while they continue the search for their loved ones. So as we get updates about that, I can send them along. That's still in the works. But I just think, you know, what's crucial right now is for people to be aware that this took place, to be aware that this is ongoing, and to be ready to continue to mobilize in their own cities and towns. Just make posters, hang them up. I mean, it would be amazing if there could be student-led actions like student strikes or other you know, walkouts or whatever in the U.S. or in Canada in response to this, just like there has been in Mexico. But, you know, I think the crucial thing is just for it to be on people's minds and to try to stay critical and to try to stay aware of what's going on, because this is something that's not going to end, I don't think, anytime soon.
And it seems to have a lot of possibilities within it for actual change outside of just a return to the status quo and a return of the students, which would be great to get the students back, but the status quo seems not to be all that great.
Well, I mean, I also think, like I said, this event represents a before and an after, right? So if we're talking about an after, we're talking about a status quo that's different. And we're talking about a status quo where apparently 43 students can be detained by police and disappeared in a country. This is not a democratic country. You know, this is like totalitarianism that we're living in here. And like in a country where something like that can happen, you know, so what we're looking at is a status quo that's actually getting way scarier for people, way scarier, way more intense. The levels of repression are absolutely frightening. A lot of people here are petrified. They're scared to protest. You know, they're scared to say anything. But at this point, it's like, even if you're scared, it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean you're safe, right? If the police can detain you, and then you disappear like that, and they can do that to 43 people at one time. I mean, this is, and like I said, this has been going on in Mexico for a long time, but this event is sort of something that I think, you know, has just gone absolutely way too far, and it's deep into the imaginations of people throughout the country. So, you know, there is potential, and it's exciting to go to assemblies and to be mobilizing with people. And, you know, it's not just exciting, but it's relieving, because otherwise, you know, everyone's dealing with their anger and their fear and their sadness sort of on their own. And I think what's important is that we are collectively organizing in response to this. But, you know, what the future holds, again, we don't know. It's going to be a very difficult, you know, time. And one of the things that people keep saying is, like, you know, that this isn't going to be the last massacre in this country. And we don't want to just keep organizing responses to massacres. We need to figure out how to organize against this system. But that's something that, you know, is something that we're just starting to sort of talk about. I mean, I've been working on this book about the drug war for about 4 years now. And like, this is like the first time that I've really experienced like wide-ranging groups of people talking openly about things like mass graves and kidnappings and all these things that have been happening in other parts of the country. So it's a very difficult time right now in Mexico as well. It's kind of inspiring, but it's mostly just horrifying.
I can only imagine. So one of the elements of the massacre that stood out in my mind, but I can't actually find the article that talked about it. But there's the, I think it's called the Red Press in Mexico that publishes in certain areas pictures of people who'd been executed or graves or like bodies. And there was the photo of a student, a young man who had escaped off of the buses and then talked to the media that night after the attacks. And his body was found mutilated that same evening. His face had been ripped off. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. This is a young man whose face was removed after he was murdered by police.
And that's,
his face was removed and it was pulled down over his neck.
Yeah.
And this, you know, this, no, this harkens basically to like acts of, this is an act of terror. This is a very strong message for other students and other people, you know, in Guerrero and Iguala and Mexico, all over the place, saying like, if you stand up and protest, if you participate in a protest, if you cover your face in a protest, this is how you could end up. And I mean, there's been acts like this, unfortunately, in other instances in the country. It's just another, not just, but I mean, it's another clear act of terror aimed at the population.
His name was Julio Cesar Mondragon.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I couldn't remember the name before. But yeah, it's horrific terrorism.
Well, and like as you've mentioned, I mean, it's not that there's like sort of a complicated, necessarily confusing relationship between the police and these so-called narco-traffickers. Like, there's actually no separation between the people who are moving drugs, the people who are murdering students, the people who are disappearing students. They're all, you know, police in uniform or not in uniform, basically. I mean, it's a scary thought, but it is an oversimplification. Things are slightly more complex than that, but only slightly. I think it's closer to accurate to say that there is no separation between state security forces and narco-trafficking groups in this country than it is to sort of assume that there is that separation there, scarily enough.
Do you know of any sort of like extra parliamentary resistance outside of the auto defenses and the student protests? Like, have there been any responses from guerrilla groups or the Zapatistas or like?
Yeah, I mean, the Zapatistas did a big march, a silent march, and they put out a statement, which is excellent, after the disappearance of the students. There's also the EPR guerrilla group in Guerrero who have put out a number of communiques and said that they will also be targeting the people responsible for the disappearances. But I can't comment on like the size or the meaning of the EPR communiques at this time.
That's it for the questions that I have. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I do think it's important for people in the U.S. and stuff to also just keep in mind that this, this act against the students is not an isolated act. It's happening in the context of, a war that is bringing terror against the people of Mexico, specifically against people who are, you know, poor, who are activists, who are working people, who are organized, who are indigenous, who are community landowners, etc. So all of these different groups have been living through a really intense war, varying intensity depending on what place they are in the Republic of Mexico. But that this war is a direct result of U.S. policy. This war is, it is the Merida Initiative, right? So the Merida Initiative is, the drug war for Mexico. It's based on Plan Colombia. It started here in 2008. And, since the U.S. started pumping billions of dollars a year into these same security forces in Mexico that are responsible for these acts like the disappearance of these students, violence in this country has gone off the charts. And the digging of mass graves in this country has multiplied just exponentially, and massacres and all this stuff. And, I think it's important that we just stop and consider this for a minute. Like, this is not just a Mexico problem or an issue of corrupt people in Mexico. U.S. policy has led to the militarization of this country over the last 7 years, the deepening of militarization and the paramilitarization of Mexico as well. So it's not like, we're not separate from this if we don't live in Mexico. And I think it's really important for people to think about it. I mean, it's part of a reactionary, like, right-wing attack, assault on the people that, I argue in my book can actually benefit transnational capital and transnational corporations. So just that, right? Like, let's keep the big picture in mind here too when we're talking about these students and we're talking about overall what's happening in Mexico, which is a, scary militarization and paramilitarization, total impunity for people responsible for these crimes. And, terror against the population of this country.
And it's also the kind of thing that directly affects us in the U.S. In as far as who our neighbors are and our community members. Can you talk a little bit about what the transnational corporations, like how they benefit from displacements and massacres and things like this and the narcos?
Sure.
And also how immigration fits into that too? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, what you have is a sort of Colombia model where, like, people are being displaced or have been displaced, including in Guerrero State. Actually, it's happened more than once, off of lands that are, like, resource rich or that, for example, have minerals in them or oil or gas or whatever. So people are being pushed off of their lands through terror, so through massacres, through gunfights, through mass disappearances, etc. And basically, this is clearing the way for capital, you know, getting the pesky communities off the land, or, you know, getting rid of pesky activists by, you know, murdering them, but, you know, that they be murdered by supposed members of drug cartels and the entire murder be dressed up as something that, you know, means that the victims were involved in the drug trade somehow, and that's why it happened. Instead of, you know, that's the analysis that we'll get in the media and from the state, instead of, you know, the obvious, okay, what happened? Well, these activists were murdered by a paramilitary group because they're resisting a Canadian mining company, for example, as happened a couple years ago in Chihuahua, in the case of Meg Silver and Benito Juarez. So that's kind of one example of how. And then there's also, you know, the militarization. So you also have the strengthening of state forces. You know, federal police here look like soldiers, huge weapons. You know, they go around masked on the back of trucks. You know, so like, that kind of militarization and paramilitarization is beneficial in terms of clearing territories, also protecting the interests of transnational capital, you know, silencing activists and silencing the media. Like, there's been tons of journalists who've been murdered here. I don't have the last count on hand right now, but like dozens and dozens of journalists have been murdered in the last 6 years. And people, you know, through the use of terror, people are made to fear speaking out. People are made to fear organizing. You know, I actually read that the march that happened in Ciudad Juarez after Ayotzinapa was like the only march that people can remember that was a large, like the largest march that people can remember since Juarez was militarized in 2008. So, you know, these policies all lead to a populace where people are scared, where organizations are disarticulated, where the social fabric is destroyed, where opponents are eliminated. And all of those things make, you know, better conditions for transnational capital to operate.
The new book, Drug War Capitalism, what sort of works went into that book?
Sure. It's actually not out yet. It'll be out in a month. First event on November 15th in San Francisco, and there'll be info on the AK Press page. Yeah, the book basically is just it's a longer version of what I just articulated in terms of how the drug war is a war that's beneficial to transnational capital, and it's beneficial to these reactionary states. And I start with a look at Colombia and Plan Colombia from 2000 to 2006. And then I have a sort of focus on Mexico, so how the drug war has militarized, paramilitarized this country, and how it's also, you know, money coming through the Merit Initiative has also contributed to all of these policy reforms and changes that have happened in Mexico over the last number of years, which includes, you know, like the privatization of the state oil company, which, not coincidentally, the same thing happened in Colombia during Plan Colombia, right? So I look at, like, the drug war as something that is political. And, you know, my critique comes more from, like, not looking at, like, I don't write about, like, drug war or drug cartels. I really focus more on the drug war. Like, the state-led war on drugs is actually what turns out to be the most damaging, you know, sort of element of this in terms of like people's experiences and the experience of the population. I also have a chapter on Honduras and a chapter on Guatemala. So I reported from all four of these countries and found, you know, sadly, like there is just a lot of similarities between, you know, what's happened in Colombia, what's happened in Mexico, in Guatemala and Honduras in terms of like the impacts that U.S. policy have had, basically like more violence, more paramilitarization, and more foreign direct investment.
Thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation and for the work that you do. And I look forward to reading the book.
It's going to be out for sure in November. And I definitely encourage folks to pick up copies, pirate copies, photocopy it, whatever. Like, I would really like this book to get out far and wide. I think it'll be useful for folks to, you know, be able to expand and deepen their analysis of the drug war. I think it's crucial because, unfortunately, as we've seen with Ayotzinapa, like, it's not something that's over. That's another thing I maybe could just quickly mention. Like, sure. The government, the new pre-government, since they've come into power, their whole thing has been like, you know, the drug war is over. It's a thing of the past. That was the PANS policy. We're not like that, whatever. And really focusing more on the economic growth of Mexico and, you know, putting a positive spin on things and so on. But, you know, what Ayotzinapa just absolutely rips open is that, you know, that myth, that is a total myth. The drug war here, the war on drugs, which is actually a war on people, is like alive and well in this country, unfortunately.
So how can people keep up on your writings?
I have a website, which is donpaley.ca, or you can check me out. I have a Facebook page, which is just people, if you look up Don Paley on Facebook, or on Twitter, it's Don _. So Twitter is probably the best. Like, I've been tweeting a lot of stuff about Ayotzinapa and like really good articles that are coming out and so on. So again, my Twitter is just Don and then _. Those are the main ways, I guess.
Cool. Thanks a lot for the conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio.